Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. On this episode, we'll be discussing if vampires are even scary anymore. Plus, we're going to play a little Vampire Avengers game. Finally, we can discuss the fact that Oscars now have a stunt category. I know it's a few days after this happened, but we're going to talk about it anyway because I've been wanting this for 15 freaking years. And spoiler-free review of Sinners and a whole lot more. So let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me today are my fellow host, John Davenport.
Hey, buddy.
Troy Heinrichs.
Apologize in advance if this is going to suck.
And Amanda Sink won't be here because, get this, she lost her laptop. It happens. Remember, you can always find more information at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Find us on Facebook, X, Threads, or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you can rate and subscribe on your preferred podcast app. Please be sure to check out our true crime podcast, Inspired by a True Story, where our next mystery will be, where is Amanda's laptop?
I mean, I could make an easy joke about Amanda, but I respect her too much.
Aw, no you don't.
At the end of this, just so you know, John Davenport and Troy Heinrichs and Scott Clark are doing a Last of Us dedicated podcast on Patreon, okay? And we talked about it last week. I'm not going to go into a big, long ad for it. But the first episode of that is going to play at the end of this episode. So they're going to talk about The Last of Us Season 2 premiere in detail and some other stuff. So stick around for that at the end. Patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider.
And if you didn't watch the episode, don't listen.
Great sales pitch.
Well, they'll be spoiled. It's going to be a fantastic season.
All right, let's get into our normal episode. So this is a big, big news, I think. And this happened right before we went live with our episode last week, so we couldn't talk about it. And I'm not passing this up because I've been talking about this the entire time I've been doing this podcast, and I've been doing it longer than anybody.
You finally giving up drinking?
No.
No, he's just going to do that more.
Yeah, now I can celebrate.
He's going to celebrate.
I am going to celebrate because I've been trying to get it. And it's, you know what's awesome is I've been asking for a stunt Oscar forever. So long-time listener, I got a lot of emails and messages from long-time listeners saying, hey, it finally happened. One listener who I hadn't heard from in maybe 2 or 3 years sent me a message out of the blue and just said, they finally did it. And I know they don't listen anymore. That was great. I'm like, hey, that's cool that, you know, you realize it made an impact to me anyway. So I appreciate those nice thoughts. But stunts finally have a category for best stunt design. And I'm going to kind of go through to explain this a little bit. So there has never been a stunt Oscar, so to speak, right? There's never been a reward for the people that risk their frickin' lives day in and day out. And many have championed for the need for a best stunts Oscar, notably Chad Stahelski, who was Keanu Reeves' stuntman in The Matrix before directing John Wick. David Leitch, who along with Ryan Gosling turned their last movie, The Fall Guy, into kind of a press tour for stunt people. Leitch and Stahelski, they started the 8711 Action Design Group, so they know very much the stunt community. They're both stunt men and the stunt coordinators, and they appreciate the stunt community. Leitch and stunt coordinator and designer Chris O'Hara of Stunts Unlimited and others, they made several presentations to the Academy, leading to the Board of Governors finally approving the new awards category. I don't know what took them so damn long. I don't know. It's been a pain point of mine for over a decade. It just irritates the hell out of me because this is a big part of movie going, and there was no recognition of these very, very talented men and women. So the board of directors of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences announced the creation of the annual competitive Academy Award for Achievement in Stunt Design. Basically, it's a team effort, so it's a team award, apparently. And it's going to begin with the 100th Academy Awards. So it took 100 goddamn years for it to happen, but it's going to happen in 2028 for films that are released in 2027, which means, you know, Tom Cruise is probably getting gearing up to have a lot of movies rolling out in 2027. He's like, I got to have at least 3 of these bitches. I'm going to see what I can do. And David Leitch said, quote, stunts are essential to every genre of film and rooted deep in our industry's history. From the groundbreaking work of early pioneers like Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, and Charlie Chaplin, to the inspiring artistry of today's stunt designers, coordinators, performers, and choreographers. This has been a long journey for so many of us. Chris O'Hara and I have spent many years working to bring this moment to life, standing on the shoulders of the stunt professionals who fought tirelessly for recognition over the decades. We are incredibly grateful. Thank you, the Academy. So I just want to know for you guys, you know, I've just talked about it for 5 minutes. It's a big deal for me because I really, really do appreciate and respect the stunt community and what they do. Does this matter to you? Because some people don't care about the Oscars at all.
I'm somebody who doesn't really appreciate the Oscars in a lot of different ways. I get bored. I get tired. There's a lot of movies that end up getting recognition that I don't ever watch. This sounds like something that can draw me to pay attention to the Oscars. At least in some way, the movies that I enjoy, the fun popcorn-filled extravaganza of the show will be actually be on screen and be part of the Oscars, and I'm down for that.
What if The Brutalist gets a stunt Oscar?
Brutal. I got nothing for you.
All right, Troy, sorry.
I mean, we've actually spent a lot of time talking with the gentleman from The Blacklist who did the stunt coordination on that TV show mm-hmm. about this exact topic and just...
Because Emmys have had it for a long time.
Yeah, because he's been up numerous times nominated for the Emmy side. So to not have one for the movies, we always thought that was kind of a miss because nobody really watches the Emmys anyway.
Damn. Shade thrown.
The big thing here, though, is and Aaron has told me that I'll never just agree with anything. I have to have my point of view.
I mean, facts are facts.
This is a good step. It's not a full step, though. Because the fact that it's for stunt, the team, right, for the design of the stunt, it's not still honoring the person that's actually executing it, who actually puts their life on the line. So I'd like to see this go one step further after that 100th to actually give, you know, best stunt person award also, like they have best actor, best supporting actor.
Well, this is one that the stunt community seemed okay with. David Leitch and Chet Stahelski themselves have gone to bat for this award in this kind of way. And I think that's because the stunt community wanted to be recognized in this way, because that's more of a team recognition as opposed to just one person. I think it's kind of hard to identify just one person in a stunt. There's a lot of people involved in making a stunt work. I mean, I get what you're saying. I'm just saying, like, I get why they are doing a design award, a cumulative award.
Because you have to do the whole planning and pre-planning and then execution and rehearsals checks, and all of that all stuff. That. Yeah. So, I mean, this is great. Like, I'm glad for that because the team all has to be there in order for the actual stunt to go off successfully. But that person that's also still doing that tumbling and falling and banging knees and blowing up and rolling over, like, I still think that that person should get an award also. To be seen.
I'm just very excited. I am very excited for this. I can't wait to see it at the ceremony. Some other news. This is finally confirmed this week. God, it's been talked about forever, but it's confirmed. These are the new faculty for Hogwarts for the Harry Potter show. And we've got John Lithgow as Albus Dumbledore, Janet McTeer as Minerva McGonagall. God, why would I be the person that says these?
You can just say Professor McGonagall.
Thank you.
We know who it is.
Papa Asidu as Severus Snape, Nick Frost as Hagrid, which is crazy. Sold. He's lost a lot of weight. Luke Thallon as Quirrell and Paul Whitehouse is Argus Filch. Don't know who the kids are going to be yet. They're still vetting those guys. Are you guys still excited for Harry Potter series? Or are we just like, we saw the movies. Why are we doing this again still?
I could totally go for a Harry Potter series, mostly because the movies are great. They have the holidays kind of behind them as well. There's a lot missing from those movies, though, and this would be a great opportunity to dig into those parts of the stories that they left out, those characters they didn't give enough time to, those characters they just completely left out, and just have a little bit more fun with it. I can say that it'd be great to deal with this in the form of a television show. Do we need it? I don't think so.
We don't need any of it. We don't need any of anything.
We don't need another Avengers movie, but we're going to get that, so yeah.
Well, I need to see how different it's going to be when RDJ has a different character to play.
Like, we're not even going there yet. The Thunderbolts are coming, man. And every time I see the Thunderbolts trailer, I get so excited because the trailer looks so different than anything Marvel's actually done.
That looks fun. I think Thunderbolts looks so like good. A lot of fun. Yeah.
Looks
yeah.
so good. Harry Potter. Yes. I'm cautiously excited about going back to the Wizarding World.
Okay.
Because I still don't know who the Holy Trinity are of the casting of the kids, because if you'll get that wrong, it's going to suck big time, because everybody's so ingrained with the original Hermione and Ron and Harry. Yeah, so
you got to really give them credit, right, for casting that so perfect out of the box. Those three did a great job. Like, they were
great job.
Pitch perfect.
Individually playing off of each other, playing off of the adults, like all of it was great.
Yeah. I mean,
so you mess that up, it's going to be just dead in the water before it even starts. But like John said, like, just, you know, same thing with Wicked, you know, a 2.5 hour play turned into a 5 hour opus over two parts, because it is based on a book and the books have a lot of extra information. Yeah, so to be able to expand on the story and put in some of that stuff that was missing from the books into a TV series, I think is great.
I mean, there's like important information that can be in that fleshed out version. It's kind of like if you go watch Lord of the Rings, then you watch the extended versions of Lord of the Rings, right? Which I don't know is Troy's favorite topic, but you know, you get, was it Aragorn? Aragorn? He is actually like 80 something years old or whatever, but you don't find that out in the normal versions. You only find that out in the extended version. So, I mean, like that sort of thing.
True statement.
Yeah. You can flesh this stuff out with more time. So it could be really exciting, but man, imagine if you get Harry Potter wrong and you got Eric Stoltz Back to the Future, that shit, where you're like, after the first season, you got to recast him. Oh, you did something different with your hair. Wouldn't that be sad?
They would have to throw like a rubber suit over the character just to have CGI in the Trinity back in there. I hate saying calling it the Trinity, but that's just weird now that I've said it. But to get Harry and Hermione, they'd have to do like a CGI the original characters back in and just have them puppeted around.
I don't think CGI is quite there yet. That's the future of AI. Now they just say, what if we get the young Emma Watson and the young Daniel Radcliffe? We just stick them in here. Just CGI them.
Yeah. It's the answer to everything.
I would watch that. It'd be creepy, but I'd watch it. Are you going to watch the Godzilla Minus One sequel?
Yes.
That they're actually making? Like, they confirmed it?
Yes.
Do they call it Godzilla Plus Two? Minus two? What are they doing here?
Like, square root Godzilla? I don't know.
I still don't understand
that
title.
That would be completely irrational, Arjun.
What?
If you take a square root of a negative number, it's completely irrational.
I just can't with you people. I don't do math.
At one point I knew what the whole minus one deal was, and I've now forgotten what it is, but at the same time, like, I don't really care. It's the story that I dig, and they did such a beautiful job with the original, well, not the original, but with minus one, of telling a heartbreaking, endearing story that only had Godzilla as a force of nature. I'm okay with doing that again.
Hey, can I ask a question? Side tangent.
Yeah, what's up?
Have either one of you guys watched, I mean, all the ruckus about the White Lotus, have either one of you watched this show?
No.
No.
So I gave it a shot.
Uh-huh.
Season one,
yeah. I started from the beginning, right? I'm not going to start, even though it's an anthology. I think that'd be weird. And I get the concept, different resorts right around the world, beautiful locales. First season has Alexander Daddario and Sydney Sweeney both in it.
Oof, that sounds problematic.
Easy.
I said that sounds problematic.
Easy. It's still... I didn't like it. I just don't like it. It's just rich people dealing with rich problems, I guess. I mean, I don't quite get what the appeal is to this show. I know. I'll maybe give another episode or two, but there's a lot of hype about something I just can't get into. Reminds me of Succession at a resort.
Yeah.
I would only watch it if I have nothing else to do. And right now I have too much on the plate.
Well, there's plenty of other things. So if it's not for you, you just find something else. Yeah. It's not like running short on material.
Handmaid's Tale, Andor, You final season.
Matlock, that's a better option.
Matlock's fun, man.
I just said that.
Kathy Bates is good. She's got the goods.
I've been watching it the last couple of weeks. I'm all caught up on it, and I enjoy the show. It has no real bearing in a courtroom. It has no real thing going on as far as that's concerned, but it's cute, it's fun, and she is amazing.
You know what I found out this Kathy Bates lady is good at, right?
Acting.
Is playing people that are crazy or have multiple personalities or flip on a dime or can be real nice and sweet and then just start, you know, banging your kneecap with a gavel. Yeah, like that. She's really good at that.
You're saying Kathy was typecasted from the beginning of her career?
I'm saying she's good at something. She's excellent. She's excellent. Okay. She's a great actress. She really is.
She's great.
All right. Well, our show is independently funded and all of the expenses are from our own pockets, and Patreon helps fans support the favorite podcast. So if you want to get immediate access to all the content in your respective tier, go to patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. And that's where you're going to find John's Power Hour, where he's covering The Last of Us. And I believe maybe Stranger Things later this year.
That was not an ad.
Mm-mm. That, yeah, definitely not an ad.
Just a mention.
Just a mention. Just a mention. Now let's go to our From the Outside In topic. Topic this week, are vampires still scary? Really? Sinners is out. It's gotten a lot of hype. We'll tell you how we feel about it a little later in the show, but are they scary? Are vampires even scary? And I think Nosferatu out of the equation, just because that's probably the one where I will say yes. Outside of 30 Days of Night, I can't remember another vampire movie in the last 20 years that scared me. So that's why I'm asking. Do you find vampires scary in any way, shape, or form still? Or did Twilight ruin them forever?
Oh, Twilight didn't ruin them forever. Definitely gave him a bad name, but...
Depends on how you play them, right? The whole idea of werewolves, vampires, monsters, demons, all this other stuff, it all comes from the ancient stories of old about how people were invaded by monsters and they kind of did all these scary things.
Not having control of your own faculties, right?
Not having control. The whole thing is all about how people couldn't accept the natural evil that's within people. And when you lean on that, if you lean on the origins of like the fact that these are real people doing something that just turns out to be a little bit turned up to 11 a bit, it makes it even worse. But when they ground it in that it's a serial killer and what kind of things a serial killer can do when they're blending into a crowd or when they are convincing people to do what they want them to do, all these things, those are what makes a vampire scary.
Vampires would be scary if they had to like get out of their coffin and be like tiptoeing around the house because they didn't know if someone closed a curtain. That's all.
Start walking around and smoking up the house.
Yeah, because they're not scary. They're not scary at all.
It took us a long time to get here, Troy.
Yeah, that was a long trip.
Fine, cut it out.
All right, try something else.
Take two.
Vampires have never been scary since like the 80s, I would say. Sometime in the 80s, early 90s, there was a complete shift in what the vampire is. And the vampire is the person that I want to sleep with. It became this romanticized, sexualized, fetishized thing that people are just drawn to. And that's what leads to things like Fright Night or The Lost Boys or Vampire Diaries or True Blood, you know, even Buffy and Angel to a degree. So it's just a matter of, you know, now that we've sexualized it to a point that people fantasize about a vampire having sex with them, why am I scared of that?
It's actually a good point. I mean, it took you a while, but you got to a good point. Yeah. I mean, if you really think about it, now granted, I will say that's really how Dracula was originally told, right? It was a romanticized story. So people like kind of borrow off that. But the monster of it was much more terrifying in Dracula as opposed to what we see today. And I've never really understood the romantic aspects of it. What are you falling in love with? Somebody who just sucks the blood of randos? Like, that's hot to you? I mean, well, he can't be faithful because he's got to suck everybody's blood and he's not picky.
Well, that's just the thing, right? It's not a matter of the vampire having to be, lack of a better term, monogamous with the person that they bite, right? Because the vampire needs to eat. It needs to drink blood. And what it does is it gets a female and then latches the female to them. So that way the female is actually the person that brings in other bait, right? So you have the female being a temptress, if you will, to find other prey. And that's how the female can then feed their master, is by bringing other prey to them in order to sustain life for the vampire.
If I'm watching a vampire movie, TV show, whatever, I need someone who's evil. I want them to be likable in a way because I think that helps. You know, Jerry Dandridge in either Fright Night, Colin Farrell or Chris Sarandon, either one of them wears that well, right? It's about being smooth and kind of seductive in a way, but also a complete monster when it's time. And yeah. That's just, that can be, because it's disarming, And I think disarming can be terrifying in many ways. I think maybe Colin Farrell is probably the last time I saw a vampire that really was scary or was intimidating. I don't even know if I can use the word scary, but intimidating for sure, because I was fearful for the other characters because he was such a monster. And too often they kind of neuter him, especially these days, because they want you to like him a little bit. They want you to kind of root for him. And I don't know if I want to root for a vampire. I mean, they murder people. That's kind of the only way they can live, is if they murder people. Inherently, I think that's a bad thing.
They don't have to. They could drink pig's blood like Angel did, but...
Yeah, but he didn't like that.
Yeah, he didn't like it. Wasn't a cool way to do it.
Vampires are like the embodiment of temptation to some degree when they're portrayed like this. People get to enjoy the thrill of surrender, the fantasy of being chosen by a creature like this. That's why it's so easy to romanticize vampires. But it's, again, when you look at it from the point of view of it, of let's throw it into like a true crime aspect or a serial killer.
True crime
aspect.
Vampire tale. That's interesting. All right.
I mean, I'm just saying, like, to look at it from the point of view of like as if it were a true crime thing, what you'd be looking at is a serial killer. And a lot of times serial killers are these disarming people. They're these people who are able to talk their way into situations they have no business being in. And in a lot of cases, if you look at like history, take Ted Bundy, for example, women were throwing themselves at Ted Bundy when he was being put on trial. The same thing with Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. Again, he had a name like the Night Stalker. So you compare that to the modern day vampire and it works. And it works in reality for all those reasons.
But still with a serial killer concept and then all these people throwing themselves at Ted Bundy, right? It's still a sexual drive component.
Exactly. Like I said, the embodiment of temptation, the thrill of surrendering your body to somebody. So that's why it's so easy to kind of like make this thing. But I think Aaron's on a good point. And it was a point that I was going to bring up later anyway, is that Jerry Dandridge is a great vampire because he is not only is he that serial killer kind of person, but he's charming. He's fun to watch on screen. Funny when he lets go all the way, and he is a scary creature.
Oh man, in the first Fright Night, one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie, if not my favorite scene, is when he, you know, if you've never seen the movie, it's a kid's next door neighbor is a vampire, and he basically comes to fall in love with his girlfriend because she looks like someone from his past. They never really established exactly who that is, unless you read the book, then you can find out more. So they're in a dance club scene, and basically they're trying to escape him, and he ends up seducing her on the dance floor, essentially. And it's just, you know, watching him manipulate her and his just sheer glee about how horrible it's making Charlie Brewster, the kid next door, feel. And It's just a really cool and cruel scene that really just shows you how evil he can be and how manipulative he is. Even though, I mean, it's the 80s, so you kind of forget totally that she's totally a teenage girl and this is weirder than it should be. But it's a great scene, and it really does like illustrate how menacing a vampire should be. Another one I love is, and nobody's ever seen it but me, apparently, but Vamp.
It rings a bell.
With Grace Jones, where... It's yes. like an underground yes. strip club.
Yes.
Oh my God. So it's like two guys, they got to go out and find a stripper. And so they find this underground. It's very 80s, very pastel, very campy in a lot of ways. But Grace Jones is like the head vampire, and it's a club full of vampires. And they just kind of pick on people that no one's going to miss, essentially. And she's vicious. I mean, she is a vicious vampire. And I really, really thought she was great in terms of, she was very seductive when she could be lured people in, and then she would just devour them like a meal. Such a good vampire flick, I thought. Plus you deal with friendships. That's fun.
Going the other direction, Innocent Blood from John Landis.
That was a terrible movie.
I had so much fun with it when it first came out.
Did you really?
Yeah.
That's when I realized, like, John Landis is not a good director anymore. That and Beverly Hills Cop 3. Those are the two things.
You may be onto something there, because I have rewatched it, and I do own it on digital somewhere, and I do rewatch it from time to time whenever I'm drawing or something. It's not really great, But it goes back to that, the other thing people end up doing, if it's not the fact that they are romanticizing vampires, they like to turn vampires into anti-heroes. So there, it's another way of like taking the teeth out of what should be a scary creature.
I see what you did there.
Yeah.
I see what you did there. I'm taking the teeth out of a vampire. Can you imagine a gummy vampire? That would suck.
That would be terrible. You
just have to nub on them.
Yeah. But again, it's like that. It's that whole idea of just making them just likable, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work in the long run. I enjoy that movie because it's terrible. It's one of those reasons why I do like it. I'm like, that's a bad movie, and I have fun with it for that reason. But it's part of the epidemic of bad vampire movies when they lose track of what it is that the vampire is supposed to be. Now, on the flip side of that, you have a similar sort of idea of an anti-hero vampire, but scary in her own right, and that's Ellie from Let the Right One In.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I find her to be a terrifying idea for a vampire is because you have basically a 10-year-old girl who looks like she's innocent, sweet, disarming, all these other things, but she is an absolute destroyer of people if she wants to be.
Now, are you talking the foreign film or the remake? Actually, I think they're both pretty good.
They're both pretty good, but I love the foreign film.
Yeah, I love the idea, even though the Kirsten Dunst character in Interview with the Vampire played with that really well too. But Let the Right One In really did it justice, because it's something to see like a kid trapped in that body and just can never ever grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, and that just creates so much more anger. Plus the immaturity, you never really ever gain maturity because your body never went through the changes. So you're kind of always, it's just a really cool take on the vampire motif.
Absolutely. And again, that's what makes her terrifying, is just how disarming she is with her vulnerability, because that just makes her naturally more vulnerable. But if you don't treat her right, she will destroy you.
What I never found scary is Tom Cruise's Lestat. I always thought,
I don't think he was ever supposed to be scary.
He was just lame. There were people that Anne Rice praised his performance, and I was just really. I mean, it looks like cosplay. I never felt like Tom Cruise was any better than cosplay.
I mean, that's because that's his role in that movie. I think it's he's not there to be scary. He's not there to be the vampire.
But isn't he? I mean,
he is a vampire.
Isn't he? Vampire of that whole Anne Rice world. Now, I heard the TV version is a lot more menacing, but I mean, Tom Cruise, I thought, was weak sauce. It's not like Les Grossman. I thought Les Grossman was more scary than Lestat was. Tropic Thunder reference.
I was trying to put it together. Wait a minute. I know this one.
And maybe I don't go the deep route on a lot of this stuff, because I've just been more of like, vampires aren't scary. So I go with the comical side of things for the most part.
Like, what's a good funny vampire? Once Bitten? That's a decent.
I mean, Buffy, obviously.
Well, I knew that was, that's, yeah, sure.
You know, but I mean, like, The Lost Boys. I mean, so not scary. See, kind of scary, but not really scary.
I'll be honest, I would totally be Jason Patrick in that movie. If Jamie Gertz were like, I'm his age, and I'm like, all right, go ahead. Let me join your lame-ass bicycle gang. That's fine.
Lame-ass bicycle gang?
I would. I'm a total sucker. I would. Plus, Kiefer Sutherland was cool as hell back then. Like, he was badass.
Cool. Oh, everybody was cool in that little group of vampires of his. Everybody was.
But you didn't find it scary.
Great twist at the end. Great twist at the end.
Oh, with the dad?
Or yeah.
The stepdad?
The stepdad.
Could it be stepdad? Boyfriend? Whatever the hell he was?
Right.
See, the thing about Lost Boys is it's one of those perfect 80s movies. It's not necessarily that it was meant to be scary or meant to be something, you know, anything that it wasn't, but it was in that same vein of like, it was a perfect stepping stone from like Goonies and everything else before it to step into like, now we're going to do Goonies, but with monsters.
Okay.
And,
now you're just being ridiculous.
He's not wrong, because it's,
how
it's
is it Goonies with vampire? Sell me this pitch.
It is literally the okay, if I was the Goonies and I'm running around doing treasure hunts and pirates, and it's a thing that happens when you're like 8 to 12 years old or 8 to 14, right? And now I'm in high school and I've moved to a different town, and it's still a coming of age movie, but you're just now at a different age cycle. So you're like dealing with high school shit, and you're like trying to find a girlfriend, and not being accepted. So here's this cool gang that
sounds
I
like
joined.
A totally different movie.
Yeah, I really couldn't have sold my idea better than Troy that it just did, honestly.
Well, he sold it wrong because it's not Goonies at all. It's just a coming of age tale, but there's no group.
He's saying it's in that genre of a coming of age story.
It has a Goonie in it. Does that count? I mean, maybe that helps you, but that's about as close to Goonies as Lost Boys is. The only one eyed Willie in Lost Boys is. Never mind. That was going to be a bad Jason Patrick. All right,
that was
reference.
Whoa. I can't even see you in your head right now, but I almost know where that was going to go, and that was a problem.
That's why I was laughing.
But even like back then, it was still the cheesy sexualization of it all. I mean, I'm thinking, was it Alyssa Milano in Brace with a Vampire?
Oh my God.
You know, you pull that nugget out. It's like,
that's a nugget. All right.
Nobody watched that for the vampire.
Nobody watched that for the vampire.
Not a single person. Nope.
But then you fast forward to something like a True Blood, right? Where it's like, and then there are Vampire Diaries on TV.
I fast forward Embrace the Vampire too quite a bit.
That tape got worn out.
Oh, sorry. Continue your thought.
But no, it's just that it's always been a sexualized thing since like the 80s. And I think that's why.
No, it's been longer than the 80s.
I mean, it was romanticized and sexualized in Dracula. I mean, in the books, literature, movies, it's always been a thing. But it takes away from the horror of it all for me a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. That's all.
The original story of Dracula is pretty much a story of Beauty and the Beast. That's what it's
essentially. Sure.
It's essentially Beauty and the Beast. So it's always been romanticized in one way, shape, or form or another. It's just been what kind of degree or how much they pushed that scariness to the creature to get him throughout, you know, over time. So that's, but it's always been a story of Beauty and the Beast.
Absolutely. Well, guys, do you want to build an Avengers team of vampires?
Why not?
Yeah, let's do it.
Because there are so many vampires these days in movies and TV, right? So let's say the world is under siege by a monstrous invasion, and the only ones who can help us are vampires, because they don't die, right? That's great. They don't die, which makes them pretty elite fighters. They can thrive off the blood of others. They can keep going, regenerating that way. So let's say we have to put our own team of vampire Avengers together. Now, we had a poll in Facebook, so we're going to pick a winner. Now, actually, Amanda was supposed to be here, so we're going to give Amanda.
She picked Angel.
Nope, we're not giving her a pick. No. The Facebook winner and then second place of that poll, because there's actually a tie, that's going to be the Facebook and Amanda's pick for the first two of our Vampire Avengers teams.
Okay.
So again, it's a tie. Number one is Dracula. I feel like that's strong go-to, right? So we got a good leader. Number two is Blade. So they're going to get along great, right?
Oh, yeah.
They're going to work together very, very well. And now each of us get to pick the remaining three members of our Avengers team. So we've got two strong leaders, and I think that, you know, they're going to butt heads a little bit, but at least we got a little focus and some people that have been doing this for a minute. So who would you pick, John, to add to the Vampire Avengers team?
Ooh, you know, I'm going to have to go with Viago from What We Do in the Shadows. It's kind of a wild card pick, but it's a bit awkward and overly polite, but don't sleep on him. He's still a classic vampire with centuries of experience and an unpredictable edge. But also he's great for comic relief.
Okay. What about you, Troy? Who you got to add to the team?
I mean, I have David from The Lost Boys. We just talked about Kiefer, cool in the role. He's kind of like that Iron Man layer to it because he thinks he's in charge and he thinks he's got all the answers, but he really doesn't because Cap's in charge. So Dracula's still running the show at the end of the day. So he kind of fits that mold, but Kiefer could then kick some ass and save the world if needed.
Okay. This team's looking good. I think we can kick some ass. My player, the final one is, and this should be no big surprise, but Santanico Pandemonium is my number five for the team. Now that's, if you don't know the name, for shame, sons, because if you've ever seen the dance, you know who she is. It's Salma Hayek from Dusk Till Dawn. Now, there's many reasons. One, she's a sadistic, vicious vampire who killed people for centuries before, unfortunately, she met George Clooney. And, you know, he's just a lady killer. So she's seductive. She's charming. She's gorgeous. She's Salma Hayek in her prime forever. I want her on my team.
I was going to say, let's back that up a second. Selma Hayek is still in her prime.
Right. She's just a prime number at this point, right? She's just forever prime. But she's I think she's a fantastic vampire, and also it's a cool like backstory, especially when you get into the sequels and stuff and they kind of flesh out her story. Even though the sequels are kind of terrible, I still like her backstory. But it's a cool vampire. She's vicious and she doesn't mince emotions. She's not pausing. Like when it's time to kill, she goes for it. She just shouldn't throw out a line when George Clooney's got a steak in his hand. So that's who I'm going with. So that's our team. So our team is Santenico, Pandemonium, David from Lost Boys, Dracula, Blade, and who is it from? I don't watch that show. So
it's from the movie, and it's Viago. Which is Taika Waititi's character.
Okay, so not the one with the sandwich.
No, not the one with the sandwich. He would have been perfect too.
All right, that's our vampire team. Hopefully we survive. Now let's go to some upcoming attractions. Troy, you and I can do this. I'll take Amanda's part. What's coming out theatrically?
Sounds good. Ben Affleck and John Bernthal are coming to your screen on April 25th with The Accountant 2. Christian Wolff applies his brilliant mind and illegal methods to reconstruct the unsolved puzzle of a Treasury Chief's murder.
My favorite description of autism, The Accountant series. Yeah.
Also coming out April 25th is Until Dawn, based on the PlayStation game. A group of friends trapped in a time loop where mysterious foes are chasing and killing them in gruesome ways must survive until dawn to escape it.
Now, before you go on, I played that game twice. Have you played it?
I started it, didn't go back to it.
Okay. I love that game. The movie does not look like the game at all. So it's kind of like the opposite of Last of Us, but I'll still give it a shot.
Well, The Legend of Ochi is also dropping on April 25th in a remote village on the island of Carpathia. A shy girl is raised to fear an elusive animal species known as Ochi. But when she discovers a wounded baby Ochi is left behind, she then escapes on a quest to bring him home. And then I saw the trailer for this. I am so excited. Cheech and Chong is coming back for one last movie. April 25th, Cheech and Chong's last movie will explore their 5-decade career performing stand-up, making records, starring in hit films, and it covers their lives, their comedy partnership, and their lasting influence on pop culture. And I can't wait.
I will watch that just out of respect.
Yep, exactly. So many one-liners, so many things you can just like rattle off from over the years, and it's a passing of the torch, if you will.
Yeah, it's their last hurrah, so to speak.
By torch, I mean blunt.
Jesus. All right. Dork. What do we got? So Freaky Tales on April 24th, Pedro Pascal, who's literally in everything. Does this guy say no to anything at this point?
I hope not, because he's got to like really bank it up, because at some point all this love and appreciation for Pedro is going to stop.
I don't think so. It's going to ride for a while, but he's very close.
Zaddy.
Yeah. He's getting very close to burnout for people. You know, you can't be in everything. You just can't without having some burnout for people. They're going to start saying, I need a break from Pedro. And you don't want that. So in 1987, Oakland, a mysterious force guides the town's underdogs. In 4 interconnected tales, teen punks defend their turf against Nazi skinheads. A rap duo battles for hip-hop immortality. A weary henchman gets a shot at redemption, and an NBA All-Star settles the score. That's going to Video On Demand.
Is that by A24? Because that sounds like an A24 film.
It sure feels like an A24 movie. Neighborhood Watch, which I'll have a review for you when that comes out. April 24th, Simon Jack Quaid, a young man grappling with mental illness, becomes convinced that he has witnessed an abduction. When he reports it to the police and they refuse to believe him, he reluctantly seeks the help of his neighbor, Ed, who's played by Jeffrey Dean Morgan, a jaded, retired security guard with his own troubled past. As the unlikely duo delves deeper into the mystery, their pursuit of the truth forces them to confront not only the dark secrets surrounding the disappearance, but also the many unspoken wounds that haunt them both. And also, Jack Quaid doesn't say no to much. Guys and everything this year.
That also sounds like really actually interesting.
It does. Yep, it does. And then we've got Andor. Season 2 comes out April 22nd on Disney Plus. Troy's excited. I might go back and watch it one of these days. And then, hey you, it's the final season, April 24th on Netflix. Now, I want to ask you guys, who's excited for you? I am. I still like you. That's a guilty pleasure for me.
I have plans to already binge watch that day.
No shit. You got plans for it?
Hell yeah. I'm excited.
Okay.
I'm good.
Wow.
I watched the first season. I didn't need anything after the first season. I have not gone back.
Arjun is not wrong. He is not wrong. The first season is pure gold. And it just, the second season is really shitty. The third season picks it back up again. The fourth season is different. So I'm really curious to see what they do for the finale.
I love the fourth season has a really cool tweak on the character.
Yeah.
Like a really cool change in the dynamic.
And you learn about the character too, which is something we don't get along the way.
It's one of those shows where it's dumb. Like, yeah, he should have been caught probably about 27 times, but my God, it's stupid entertaining. It's just like, it's like the Hallmark Channel for serial killers.
It's good though.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. Big fan.
None of this is telling me to keep on watching it, honestly.
I'm not trying to sell you, man. I'm invested. I want to see how it ends, and I hope. Well, Troy, let me ask you, because we don't know anything, right? Do you want him to live free, die?
Or die hard?
God damn it. Shut up. Live free, die hard, or go to jail?
Definitely not jail. The whole thing is that he's in a bookstore, right? So this is like a romance novel. It's a story that has to have either the rides off into the sunset ending, or it has to have the tragic death, but yet is forgiven for all of his past things.
So which one do you want?
I want the death.
You know what I want? I'm going to tell you what I want. I don't know if it'll happen. Here's what I want. I want whoever his last victim is to trap him in his cage and leave him to die slowly.
Ooh, starvation death.
Mm-hmm.
Rotting death.
In his own cage, stuck with his own thoughts.
Oh, you know what would be really cool?
What I just said is very cool.
Take that idea, but then take it one step further. Where
they're launching him to space.
Well, no,
with Katy Perry.
No, no. but he, while he's trapped in there, he writes one final book. And then when they find him finally down there, like his book gets printed and he like lives on in the actual book.
Would it be called You?
Sure.
I mean, you have to be. It's called Me. It's called Me. Why not? Let's just tweak it. Now we're going to talk about Sinners. And for this, Amanda has joined me because the other two Yahoos weren't available for this. So lead the way.
So Sinners has one of your favorite actors of all time, Michael B. Jordan. And
that's not true.
They're trying to leave their troubled lives behind. These twin brothers return to their hometown to start again, only to discover that an even greater evil is waiting to welcome them back. And this is from Ryan Coogler. It just came out in mid-April, so you got a chance to see it already. We've got Hailee Steinfeld, Michael B. Jordan. We've got Omar Benson Miller. A great cast here. What is your takeaway as someone who's not typically a fan of the MBJ?
Well, two things. One, I am a huge fan of Ryan Coogler, so that's how you get me in the door, number one. Number two, I don't dislike Michael B. Jordan. It's not like a Miles Teller thing. I just don't love Michael B. Jordan, usually.
I think it's the thing for your wife. She hates Michael B. Jordan.
She's just not a fan. She's not a fan. She doesn't find him to be a very good actor. I don't think he's a bad actor. I think he's actually very talented. I just typically, I find him to be a little over the top most times. Here, he gets to play two roles. So that's one thing I don't like right off the bat. I do not like twins because usually it's a gimmick. I don't think it's really much of a gimmick here. It really grew on me actually as it went on. But he plays Smoke and Stack. And at one point, I'm not making this up, I heard someone in the audience go, "They look alike." But it was pretty funny. Michael B. Jordan plays both parts. They're basically 1930s gangsters of a sort, and they had come back to their plantation town with a lot of money and a plan to create a bluesy club by purchasing an old barn, basically, and remaking it into a club where black people can come and relax and have a good old time on Saturday nights. And of course, there's a vampire nearby named Remick, who's played by Jack O'Connell, and he tends to gather the vamps together, and it becomes very much a From Dusk Till Dawn situation. The first hour is watching Smoke and Stack reunite and rekindle relationships, one with Hailee Steinfeld, who's an ex of Stack, and then Smoke's ex-love, and also she's into a little bit of voodoo. So you have these two that are having their parallel lives that happen for the first hour, and they reconnect with their cousin as well. who's a musician and whose father keeps telling him, you know, get away from that devil's music. In his mind, you know, he's bringing the devil to these people by playing bluesy music, which is, I get it. There's a lot of things going on, but it's essentially From Dusk Till Dawn blues edition.
You mentioned Ryan Coogler being a director that you really love to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And he's mm-hmm. really great, in my opinion, at bringing a levity between action and heart. Do you feel like you still get that kind of balance here?
Yeah, and I'll tell you this. You know, it's funny. I'm not a huge fan of Michael B. Jordan, but he's in like almost all of Ryan Coogler's
They're like BFFs movies. Or something. They've got to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, they are. I do think Michael B. Jordan is at his best when he's in a Ryan Coogler movie.
I would agree.
How's that? That's where I'm coming from. And I think that it's obvious to me he wanted to make a horror movie here. And he also wanted to put a very cinematic stamp on it. And I know there's a quote going around where he said he wanted to make sure people had a full meal instead of, you know, just giving them a snack, so to speak. And that shows. I think what he's saying is he wanted to give you a horror movie like you would expect from the trailers. Trailers kind of give too much away, if you ask my opinion. But it also gives you characters to care about. You know, as you're watching it, you actually care about both Smoke and Stack, which is hard to do with twins because you know it's the same actor, right? But he's doing a very good job of playing both parts. And, you know, just fleshing everybody out. Like, there's a good full hour of fleshing characters out. From Dusk Till Dawn did the same thing. It's very much like the same template. It's from a black perspective as opposed to, you know, Tarantino's perspective. And I would actually, this version or this film, I would kind of equate in the way to Jordan Peele meets Tarantino in a lot of ways, because he is working with black history, culture, music, and all of those factors, and really trying to merge them, religion as well, and kind of how black people see these items versus white people. And I think he's really trying to tell a deeper story than what Tarantino did. Tarantino was just going for a B movie, and here he's trying to really use that as a template to tell a deeper, more meaningful story, but also one that is fun as hell to watch.
What about the vampire? How are the rules, the house rules apply here? Do they look cool?
So, it's same vampire rules. They can't enter the barn and unless they're invited, that whole thing. There's a little bit of, you know, just like with every vampire movie, there's a little bit of finesse to the rules, you know? I feel like maybe there should be very clear rules, like, you know, only the owners can invite them in. Like, can anybody invite them in? Like, what, you know, there's a little bit of...
Are they checking the fuzziness. Deed? How are they? How do they know who the owner
exactly.
is?
Exactly. Yeah.
How maybe, does it work yeah. if you're there, a renter? Because you don't own the home, but you reside.
There's a lot of play. And I really do wonder. I mean, it's kind of interesting. One of the plays on the vampire mythos is initially Smoke's ex calls them hates, basically thinking that they're hates. They're some version of a monster. And then realizes that they're vampires and kind of goes to the next level. And it's an interesting play on the dynamic that we're used to. So most of it is pretty standard vampire fare. You know, most of it is pretty standard. If you know the rules from the other vampire movies, you know the rules.
So if the full price of admission were $10, which in this economy ain't no way, how much would you give Sinners?
I would give it $8. I think it's really, really fun. I think it's a very, very, it's a movie that's actually very layered and detailed and has a lot of information in it and a lot of heart in it and a lot of personality. And it's really trying to say something a lot deeper than just go kill the monsters. But it also has enough surface level vampire hell and viciousness to keep you on your toes. I don't think it's terrifying. It's not really scary. There's a couple jump moments, but Ryan Coogler made a very big budget, low budget movie. I mean, there's a lot of money in this. It looks very polished. It looks sleek. It's going to be a lot of fun if you can see it with a packed crowd. I think it'll probably be a blast. It was with mine, and definitely see it as soon as you can while the crowds are still in force, you know, because you never know how fast those are going to go. But I could see this movie holding on for many, many years.
Amazing.
But it is totally From Dusk Till Dawn. It's like a remake. totally a remake. It's not original. It's not. But it has that Jordan Peele touch where he threw culture and music and a lot of personality into it.
Amazing.
I thought so. All right, now Amanda is done, so goodbye. Now let's get to what you've been watching. Is there anything you want to mention for that? I think just Troy. It's Troy and I.
Yeah, I mean, I had started up Handmaid's Tale, dropped after we recorded the podcast last week, so got started on the final season there. I have to say I was pleasantly surprised with the end of the first episode and where that landed. Not going to give anything away because it was kind of cool. And I feel the big thing for this season was, is there ever any hope? And I feel like I'm feeling hope in these episodes so far, which is kind of interesting because then it's just going to get that fucking rug ripped out from underneath you.
Because you know there's a sequel series coming, right?
Yeah, that's different. It's like a sideways thing. It's
directly related. I don't want to ruin it for
you, though. I know it's directly related, but it's like it's not this, right?
It's a different.
It's a whole different group of characters. It's expands the world.
One character will continue on. I won't tell you
who. If you there's rumor that there's a couple appearances of somebody in that.
I know exactly who it is. I don't want to ruin it for you, but just keep an eye out. And lastly, before we go into this Last of Us situation with John, I will tell you that I saw The Last of Us season 2 premiere, and we're rolling into, by the time you listen to this, we're probably 2 episodes deep. Look, I played the game to a point. I actually stopped at a certain point because Ellie became very annoying to me, and I don't see that changing much from the show. So very similar issues, and I get why. It's a maturity game, right? It's somebody growing in a difficult world to grow in. I thought it was very well done. There is a new villain introduced, and I do think they kind of give a little too much away. Try to avoid the trailers for the show and just watch it. Just watch it cold. I think you'll enjoy it a lot more, but I'm really digging it. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens when it's all said and done. And with that, that's it for our show. Do you guys want to say anything in closing? Cause you're going to be talking for the next 45 minutes on this other show that I listened to. And I think, you guys did very well.
Appreciate
that.
Yeah.
Well, I know that Arjun mentioned Death of a Unicorn last week. I saw it. Dude, Arjun, fucked up, but so good.
Should be on digital by the time you hear this. So
it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, you have to check it out. I mean, also, I think Paul Rudd is now drinking the same blood of the baby juice that Tom Cruise drinks because that man does not age.
He doesn't. That's been a joke for a long time, and it doesn't stop being funny because it's true. All right, now we're going to go into John's The Power Hour, formerly a different title. Now it's called The Power Hour, where he's going to cover The Last of Us. He's going to cover every episode of the season on patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. We're only going to share the first episode in the general feed. If you want any more, just go sign up in the $3 tier or better, and you can get access to all those episodes. All right, so here you go. Here's The Power Hour. Take care. Thanks for listening. And remember, the next time you go to the theater or sit comfortably on your couch, buy popcorn.
And if you're thinking of going to Starbucks to buy a latte for $5 or $6, that covers 2 months of Patreon to hear The Last of Us.
Latte is better. Oh, wait. No, it's not.
That's your show, dude.
What a pitch, John. You're in charge of sales pitches from now on.
Like it or don't. I don't fucking care.
And we're off.
Ready now? All right, here we go. Hey, friends. Since we never seem to keep the show under 30 minutes, it's going to be a little bit of a title change here. Welcome to the Power Hour. This is a Patreon exclusive show just for you guys, our awesome supporters. Here's the idea behind the show. Each season of the Power Hour, we pick one season of a show we love. Then we go deep, episode to episode. We talk about what we liked, what made us have feelings, the cool stuff in between. Just a fair warning, there's going to be spoilers, lots of them, everywhere. So if you haven't watched the episode of the show that we'll be talking about, maybe you come back after that. So this season of the Power Hour, we're diving into the world of The Last of Us season 2. It's intense, it's emotional, and full of moments that we can't wait to talk to you guys about. I am John Davenport. I'm one of the hosts of the Hollywood Outsider podcast. I am joined with some of my very favorite people today, and they're going to be sticking around for probably the majority of this run. So coming up first, from the Gaming Outsider, it's my good buddy Scotty Clark. Hey, buddy.
Hey, John. It has been a minute since we did this together, man. I miss being on the mic with you.
I miss being on the mic with you, too, man. It makes me feel all sorts of warm and fuzzy on the inside. Kind of like I'm infected by something, you know?
I know what you mean. Like kind of like you got fungus growing inside you, right?
Yeah. And I'm a fun guy. Speaking of fun guys, from The Hollywood Outsider and Parts Unknown, we have Mr. Troy Heinrichs. Hi, buddy.
Hey, man. I don't need to look for the light because you're right here.
Yeah, I'm all of it. I'm just feeling it. All right, so we're back to this show. We loved the first season of the show. We had a good time. It made us cry. It made us laugh. It made us go, what just happened? So what are you guys hoping to see this very first episode? You know, what kind of emotions were you expecting to have? Visual, story? What were you thinking?
Troy, I'll start with you, man.
Oh, wow. I was planning for a much bigger episode than the one that we received, just because we are fans of the video game.
Yeah, same boat.
We've played the video game, so when you've been away for 2 years, as this show has been, very much like Westworld was, and you have a chance to come back with a big episode to get people talking, the buzz going, things of that nature, introducing a new character, especially with really no context at the top of the episode, and then just having them appear at the end of the episode, I don't know if that's enough to get the buzz that people probably would have been expecting for this particular episode.
I agree with you, Troy. We should, by the way, preface that Troy and I have played the games.
And John has not.
Right. So we got to kind of dance a little bit for John's sake, because I don't want to spoil anything that might happen in the show, because he's experiences as the show.
Or any of the listeners that might be in that same boat.
Exactly. With that said, I agree with you 100%, Troy. I was expecting a little bit more. And because, again, the way that Abby was introduced in the game was much more interesting. Would you agree?
Yes, much more interesting.
They did the cold open, right? That was somewhat the same, but it was just not the same cold open. And I just felt like it was a missed
opportunity. Scott telling jokes. It is winter in Wyoming after all.
Yes. So I'm the rest of the episode, though, I think was really good. I have some issues, but most of them are just like comparing it to the game, which, you know, isn't always fair. You know, this is a series after all, but there are, you know, certain things that I want to see it, and I want to be the same and not to be different, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, John, I watch it with my missus. So, right, she's sitting here. She's never played the game. I've like tried to force her to watch the entire second game, you know, YouTube movie version, mm-hmm. just so she was prepared for what's going to happen this season, and introduce her to Abby's character a little bit more. She refused. So she's just as cold as Arjun and a few others listening to the show tonight. So like she said, for her, like this was great. Like she loved it. She was back in the universe. She saw the characters and people that she like knew and loved and saw them grow up and have this like new dynamic about what's the thing between Joel and Ellie that we don't know about because no one's talking about it. So for her, she thought it was a great episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I echo that sentiment. I really enjoyed the episode. I had a good time with it. I felt every bit of emotion that they showed on the screen, which was a lot. I even got a little frustrated with some of the characters. But, you know, you guys are people who played the game. Do you think the show is going to follow the same big moments as the game at this point? Or are you going to expect it to take a different path?
I think they're going to do what the game does. I think that's a lot of why the first season was so successful, because this doesn't happen a whole lot where there are moments that are shot for shot, you know, from the game. There are lines of dialogue from the game. I mean, and they were able to appease the fans and appease those new to the series with the first season. And I hope that trend continues, that they do what the game does.
Yeah, a lot of that first 20 to 30 minutes of season one, episode one, the premiere, was very much like shot for shot for the game, right? The driving sequence of the car, the, you know, Sarah coming down the road sign, all of it just seemed very much like for the gamers, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this episode tonight didn't disappoint in that regard. There was a lot of stuff I recognized. I played the game recently, as much as 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. Stuff obviously missing, but the key, I think the thing that Craig Mazin does really well is he takes the key moments from the game and translates them to the screen in such a way that's just very artistically told, that you can show rather than say, which is what this medium is for.
Yeah.
Show me it versus tell me it.
All right. So what is going to make you nervous heading into the season then?
Boy, I think the thing that's making me nervous is what they're already talking about this going into four seasons. Is that what I've been hearing, Troy?
The show is going to go four seasons. What we don't know is, you know, is season four going to be a third game?
Right.
Because if you're talking 2 years apart, right, if they take another 2 years to do season three and then another 2 years after that, that's plenty of time for them to drop Last of Us Part Three as a game and adapt it at the same time into a TV series.
That's secretly what I hope they do. I hope that they take the first half of the game, which, again, I can't tell you what that means, John, but I hope they take the first half of the game for this season, the second half of the game for the next season, and then the fourth season is something that is fresh for everybody, and then down the road, and then we get the game after the series. Because how cool would that be to go play through the game after we've watched the series, when we watch the first three seasons, watching it after we played the game? So
that'd be a great immersive idea as far as building up a video game with a property like this on television. It's not the first time something like this has happened, but it's a great idea to try to do right, because I don't think anyone's done it right yet.
Right. And Troy, I don't think that even by the time season three is done, that if The Last of Us Part Three is a thing for PlayStation and PC, I don't think that would be ready by then. I know that sounds crazy because it's so many years in the future, but Naughty Dog just teased their next upcoming game with no real release date.
Information, yeah.
So they're going to be working on that for quite a while. And if they milk that as much as they did The Last of Us Part 1 and Part 2, I don't know if you know this, but they just released a double pack of the games right before the show came out.
The remastered versions
of the games, yes. The games already exist. They just bundled them together and made a big deal about it. So,
and I'm sure they'll sell a ton of money. And with the success of the show and the fact that season three was picked up, I mean, that's just all extra cash going back to Naughty Dog. So maybe they get extra resources, can move a little bit faster. Because really, at the end of the day, this is about story. And Neil probably has the story already written for whatever part three might be. And so, yeah, just coding it, developing it, you can do that faster with enough resources at your help.
All right. Well, speaking of story, we're going to go ahead and dive into this. So everybody, again, there's going to be spoilers here. And the way we break this show down is we talk about the first half and then we talk about the second half, in between asking some questions of each other, getting some thoughts, having some feelings, sharing some stories, drinking a little bit. Depends on what kind of day we're having. Now, I'm going to do something very specific for the listeners and tell you guys, and I've already warned my two cohorts here. If you've watched the episode, you know I'm leaving something out when I'm doing this. I'm leaving it for the end because I think it's a bigger story that we can sit down and have a whole conversation. So if you're scratching your head going, well, wait a minute, you just left something out? No, I didn't. I kind of am thinking about what I'm trying to do here. So diving right in.
It's a first. I know. But
yeah, I know. It's usually I just react. Now I'm trying to have to plan things out, but whatever. Diving in, we open 5 years after Joel's save Ellie, doom the world moment. Now, settled in Jackson, Wyoming, which honestly feels like Stars Hollow of the Apocalypse, Joel is trying to live a peaceful small town life, but under the surface, he is cracking. The weight of what he did to the Fireflies and for Ellie is eating at him. So he turns to therapy, and that therapist, Gail, played by the amazing Catherine O'Hara. Yes, Moira Rose, with a clipboard, a little bit of whiskey, a lot of pot. Honestly, it's the crossover that we didn't know we needed. Joel's in deep. There's grief, awkward silences, a lot of floor staring, but it's raw, it's real, and oof, it hits you really hard. Speaking of Ellie, she's all grown up, but not too much. She's still sarcastic, still wild, still very much a pint-sized tank. 19 and every bit as fierce as Lyanna Mormont. During practice with Jesse, she lands a perfect shot and proudly yells, "Boom, motherfucker!" You know what? Frame it. It's iconic. Put it on a t-shirt. Do whatever you want. It's a great line, a great moment for Ellie. I'm glad that she had that moment. But beneath the bravado, Ellie is keeping Joel at arm's length. Their bond is strained, and instead she's warming up to Dinah, someone she sees without the weight of all the bloody past. It's soft, it's real, and you can feel the shift coming. Ellie isn't interested in being protected anymore. She wants to stand on her own terms, and she's going to make it everyone's problem. That's right. Her terms, everybody's problem. That's the first half. Like, I expected so much more out of the first half than what we got, but there were so much jumping around and everything in this moment. What do you guys think about how this first half landed?
I think the first half followed the game fairly closely, right? We're talking about what is life like in Jackson, Wyoming? How does the council operate? How do we do patrols? Who sits on the fence? How do we collect firewood? You know, you're understanding how the town works, which I think is a very important aspect to understand that humanity does continue. America does continue, right? There's a way that we can survive this outbreak of cordyceps, and how that community functions relies on rules. And then when you have somebody like Ellie, who has the condition that she has, starts acting very cavalier about it, you know, one, could get her in trouble. Two, could get Joel in trouble. Probably why they're not having conversations about it, because they don't want people to know Ellie's condition. And so, but her cavalierness is going to get somebody killed. And I think that's something that we get to learn a lot about Jackson in a very short period of time, that that's just probably not going to be accepted. And so what happens because of that, if something were to happen?
I do find it interesting too. Like, it's 5 years later and Joel has basically cemented himself as a leader in this town, right? Like, he's the one making decisions and really helping to build and grow. There's the conversation that he's having with someone from the board, and her name is escaping me.
We call her Tommy's wife.
Tommy's wife. Yeah, that's what I was going to say, was Tommy. I didn't want to be, I don't know. I didn't know what I wanted to be, but you know, he's having a conversation with her and she's like, remember, you were a refugee at one point too. And he kind of nods and says, yeah, you're right. It's been 5 years, but I was that person on the other side of the fence looking for a place to go. And now I'm on this side making decisions. You know, 5 years doesn't sound like a whole lot of time, but in this world, I think it is. And the fact that it, you know, it's taken him that long to build up the ranks, because they don't know Ellie's secret. You know what I mean? They've kept that a secret this entire time. So, but you're right. This is all about, we are rebuilding. It's 5 years later. We've got electricity. We've got running water. We've got heat. We've got food taken care of. And all. By the way, we've also got all these jobs. We've got scouting jobs and recon and you know, sending out patrols and all this kind of stuff. There's things for everybody to do. And it's almost like there's a sense of normalcy. You know what I mean? We can worry about goofy things like romances in a post-apocalyptic world. And I don't mean that to sound like I'm taking it lightly, but like, that was nothing that was really worried about outside of the flashbacks. You know what I mean? In the first season. So now we can kind of focus on that, at least for the time being.
Yeah, it's really interesting seeing Joel right now, because he had spent the first season pretty much being a crisis mode cowboy the entire time.
Yeah.
You know, just absolutely, you know, grinding through every single thing that he possibly could. And I'm using video game terminology on purpose, but he's grinding through every single level he possibly can on purpose, trying to make sure that he gets this MacGuffin that's person-shaped MacGuffin from point A to point B. And so now he very much is just somebody who's now dealing with so many years of being in that mode, so many years of having to survive. And it really does show that it's just weighing on him in a way that is just so heartfelt and incredible. I really like the relationship, or the brief moment of a relationship that they showed us between him and Dinah. I thought that was very interesting. And the fact that she's very much like trying to engage with him and trying to get him to be more of a person, I thought that was pretty cool. What is that like in the game?
I don't remember there being much of a relationship between Joel and, is it, don't they pronounce it Dina in the show?
They might pronounce it Dina, but I see it Dinah.
But yeah, it's right. Spelled Dinah, but, and I can't remember how they pronounce it in the game, but if it's there, it's very brief in the game. I don't remember it being anything that was super fleshed out. It was kind of cool to see it, because he was trying to play mediator, you know, because there's clearly something going on between Ellie and Joel, and she's trying to play both sides a little bit and get them to talk to each other. Didn't she even like offer at one point in the episode to watch movies, the three of them together?
That's right. She really did. That was very sweet. But yeah, she seems like she's trying to bridge something there, and it doesn't seem like she's doing it for anyone's sake other than Ellie's. She's purposely putting herself in the middle and trying to reconnect the two of them, because, like, so I thought was very cool was the moment between Ellie and Joel's brother, where they're doing the shooting and then he's taking her back and they're arguing back and forth about whether or not she's going to go on the patrol. And he's like, you're just like him. And it's very funny to see that they're both the same person in different bodies.
They're both considered father and daughter, even though they're not father and daughter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Which the therapist obviously corrects. No, it's not your daughter.
The couple drinks in her.
And neither is Ellie, which is a really important observation to make.
Before we get to the Catherine O'Hara's character, I do want to mention, correct me if I'm wrong, Troy, because it kind of bugged me a little bit, Ellie's character. Like, in my remembrance of the second game of part two, Ellie had matured a lot more by the time we see her in Wyoming. Like this whole boom motherfucker and making goofy noises or goofy faces at her when they're in the shopping mart. You know, like I just felt like she was a little more grounded. She was playful, like when she would do the snowball fight with the kids and stuff like that. But I don't remember her being goofy and sassy. Like she was very hardened and more like business like than she was still a kid like she was in this episode. Am I wrong in that?
I maybe a little bit goofy. But I think she was the same. She was still telling like that, you know, the joke book was a big thing.
Yeah.
But she's still telling the joke book stuff. I'm trying to remember if the, you know, I'm immune, motherfuckers at the top of the hill.
I don't remember that either.
I don't remember if that was in the game or if that was added for this particular moment, just to like remind the audience, which is a good move by Craig, right?
To remind the audience that
she's immune. It's a great way to do it. But I don't remember if that was in the game specifically. But she does seem a little bit more... childlike versus hardened 19-year-old.
Right.
Oh, she's an asshole.
She's always been that. It's just a matter of her being more, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean but that's my point. Like she's not very mature in this. She's not very controlled. She's very much like she's going to do her own thing however she wants, no matter come hell or high water, on her own terms. And she does it in a way that makes her an asshole. She's just very self-centered, and it's not an endearing quality the way they're showing her on the screen.
And I think it's partly done too, and this is why Craig is so good on this stuff. Watch Chernobyl again if you haven't seen Chernobyl. So freaking good. Craig did that one as well. But I think what was needed for Ellie in this moment was to remind the audience, like, oh yeah, this is Ellie. Because we start the show introducing us to a whole new character. And even my wife right out of the gate is just like, is that Ellie? Because one of the challenges people have is that these two ladies, you know, are going to look a lot alike in a lot of situations when you get a side glance. And so trying to work through that initially, even in the gameplay, was kind of like, is this Ellie? Is this not Ellie? Is this a different time period? Where's the time jump? So you got some of that you got to work through. So reminding the audience with her goofiness and her comebacks and her wit, I think is good from that perspective. I didn't feel like it took anything away from the episode. And I think that it still showed the main thing, which was, fuck Joel, I'm going to do what I want. And, oh yeah, by the way, I can't die. So kiss my ass.
No, yeah. I get that. I'm not complaining from a pure watching aspect. Like if you've never played the games, it's nothing. But like I just remember when I got to episode or part two of the game, I was like, oh, Ellie's not a kid anymore. I mean, she's 19 now.
An adult.
You know, she, like I said, she had some playful moments where it was more like to make the kids laugh and smile, but there was no nonsense. There was a no nonsense tone in everything she said. There was no boom mother effer. Like I just that John, you're a very big fan of that line that grated on me. Like bugged me.
I was like, print that shit on a t-shirt. I'm with John.
Really?
That was awesome.
Yeah. I mean she delivers it very well, and it's a great moment for her. Even like her discovery of the fact that like he was like, well, I pulled my punches, and they're like, and she was like, what? Don't ever do that. Don't ever pull your punches. When in reality, like, he's three times her size. He could have folded her into a lawn chair whenever he wanted to.
Right.
Like, granted, she's feisty and she's dense and she's able to take a punch. But still, even then, there's still a lot. There's still a lot that she's really wouldn't be able to be capable of. But
well, and I think part of it is she doesn't want him to pull her punches, not because to prove herself, but she wants to get stronger. Yeah. You know what I mean? She wants to take those hits to toughen herself up because she's been through hell for that first season and she has to expect that she's going to go through hell at some point again in the future.
Yeah, I could see that. So before we move on, Catherine O'Hara's Gale. What do we think? Do we have thoughts? What do we think of her performance? Like, what do you guys got?
I loved her performance. The moment where it was zoomed in on her and it was clear she had had a few drinks and was just kind of unloading. And like you mentioned at the top of the show, there was a lot of like looking at the floor. There was a lot of her like looking around nervously. And I was just watching her eyes the entire time she spoke as I absorbed everything she was saying. I was kind of captivated by her performance. I've always loved her, but this She's felt amazing. Like a very different side of her in a good way.
This felt like very serious, and I can't tell you what anything that I thought I've ever thought she's been serious in. Troy?
Yeah, and I really liked the whole sequence because it does, for any game watchers, gives you that little piece of lore, right, that you got. You find the piece of paper on the ground that you pick up, or the newspaper clipping, or whatever it ended up being. This scene kind of felt like that because she drops this line of like, "You killed my husband," and I was like, "Wait, Joel did? Was that in season one? Did we miss that?" And you're like, "Wait, no, this is her first birthday without her husband, so this happened off camera, right, within the last year, which we didn't get to see because we did the 5-year jump."
So the assumption is he got infected.
Yeah, and then he had to take him out the way you have to take him out. She doesn't fault him for that. However, what it does is it kind of foreshadows to this decision that Joel flashes back or both. But this whole decision around, like, Joel made a decision on behalf of Ellie,
right
at the end of last season. Here again, Joel is making a decision on the behalf of Catherine O'Hara's character, right? It's a problem Joel has. Joel makes decisions without really thinking through other people's thoughts, feelings, opinions about them. Mm-hmm. Is that going to bite Joel in the ass somewhere down the line in this season?
Well, he even said in that scene that he is a good guy, and we all know that he's not.
Right.
Like, there's people that will argue with me on that because they love the relationship between Joel and Ellie, and they kind of applaud his decision to protect her and keep her alive. But he didn't. It was a very selfish decision that he did. You know, it was a decision that should have been Ellie's. And he's kind of been an a-hole throughout the entire first season as well, too. Like I said, some people will say, well, he was doing it to protect Ellie. But no, he's just not a great guy. We just are cheering for the bad guy.
Yeah. And the fact that we're talking about therapy in the show, I think, is really important, too, because, you know, you're always a villain in somebody's story, right? Mm-hmm. No one is ever perfect. No one's ever that altruistic, good person. You try to be good, you try to do the right thing, but you're always trying to do good and the right thing based on what you believe in as your values, right? Versus saying, hey, Arjun, like, do you believe in the same thing that I believe in? And Arjun's like, no, I believe in the complete opposite of that. So I'm not going to force something onto Arjun that he doesn't believe.
That sounds a lot like me, honestly.
You know? So I think a lot of that is what's going to be playing out in this season, is this whole concept of like, my values, my drive, my way, my decision, versus really thinking about how it affects other people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we did a spoiler cast for part two of the PlayStation game. And the thing that I walked away the most from that, or like right off the bat, was that the entire game was a story of empathy. Like, I really believed that. And that's exactly what you're saying. It's going to be a story of looking at this from somebody else's perspective and seeing how they feel about it. And I hope that continues in this season.
And learning how to do that, right? It's the reflection of Jackson trying to refine humanity in this crisis. Mm-hmm. 5 years later, look at what we built. But we still have to find ourselves again as what defines us as a human being again. Mm-hmm. And empathy is a real big part of that.
Absolutely.
All right. So moving right along, the second half, and we have conclusions are coming. The second half shifts into higher gear. Ellie and Dina go on patrol, but let's be honest, it's a low-key date. They wander in a derelict supermarket where, surprise, surprise, we get our first real tension builder, a new breed of infected. It's faster, smarter, and even creepier, hinting at the fungus might be leveling up. I did that just for Scotty.
I appreciate it.
I mean, there are levels of infected, so it makes sense. Yeah.
All right. And amid the dread, a spark, Ellie and Dinah share a first kiss. tender, earned, layered with all the weight of the world on their shoulders, a soft moment in the show that rarely gives us softness. It was very nice. But they also had to do it in their own way by making it really ugly, really fast. But across the map, Abby answers a story like a wrecking ball, played by Caitlin Dever. She's introduced in Salt Lake City, and she is on a mission. Her dad, a former Firefly, was one of the people that Joel killed to save Ellie. Now she's got a hit list, and Joel is at the top of the list. And she and her group, basically a Firefly Suicide Squad, try saying that five times fast, are locked and loaded. This episode wraps with tension pulsing under every scene. The guitar Joel gave Ellie shows up. The past isn't staring buried. The quiet between them is loud, and the storm is definitely coming. All right, guys. That was the second half of the story. I hope you guys understand why I wanted to break it up and not give everything about Abby, because technically in the episode, she's at the beginning of the episode, and she's only at the very end of the episode. She's not a major moment that we wanted to talk about, but I know there's a lot of things you guys have to share. So do we want to start with Abby, or do we want to start with, like, the date?
Well, I mean, there's not a whole lot that we can talk about Abby.
Okay. Screw
because
her,
it's a little bit of a dance. So why don't we just get that out of the way?
Okay.
The cold open with her and some of the other Fireflies at a mass grave was great, because as soon as I saw that braided, that single braid on the back of the head, I knew exactly who it was. I knew it was coming, but I was a little bit worried about how she was going to look. And because I've not seen Caitlin Dever in anything. I think Troy was telling me I need to see Booksmart. I think I watched like a little bit of that, but didn't get very far, and some other things that I haven't seen. So this is the first time I've actually seen her do a performance, and I was sold on her as Abby immediately. Like, this is going to work. And I got very, very excited. Troy, do you agree?
What do you think? The minute she was all like, we're going to kill him, and we're going to kill him slowly.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, fuck yeah. It's on.
What do you guys think of the prosthetic nose?
I didn't realize it was a prosthetic nose.
That's not her nose.
I guess I didn't pay attention that closely.
Oh, I couldn't miss the thing. The thing has like it has its own personality. It's like a couple of seconds away from being Steve Martin's nose from Roxanne. It's a lot.
I don't know the comparison. Like, again, I haven't seen her in anything else. This is the first thing I've seen. So, but I don't know why, if that would be a thing. I don't remember Abby's nose being a big deal in the game, but.
I mean, I've seen Caitlin in a bunch of things. Like, I didn't pick up on the difference, to be honest.
Okay.
So I'm the only one who sat there and was like superficial enough to be like, that nose is distracting.
Apparently, Jen. Apparently. If you let me put it this way. If you saw Abby in the game, Caitlin Dever is far more attractive than I got to send you a picture later of Abby in the game. so you can understand where I'm coming from, because yeah, everything is good with Caitlin Dever.
I'm just glad Caitlin's here, because Caitlin can act her ass off, and this is a role that will require someone to really act their ass off, and I am just super stoked to see where this character goes, because for those people that have played the game, Abby is a very decisive character that people were not happy about in the game when the game dropped. Not happy about her, not happy about the story, not happy about things that happen when you're playing the game, because you do play the game part of it as Abby, as you can tell based on how they cut up the episode tonight. And so, like, having Caitlin here to like give that edge off a little bit, I think, is going to help the thing, because people recognize her. She's in Dear Evan Hansen. She was in Justified. Last Man Standing, I believe she was on also. So she's been around the block. Like, this is not a like first time role. Like, so she's going to play this with, like, you know, balls to the wall, you know, emotion and emphasis. And I just can't wait to see what she does in a fight scene.
Yeah, same. Especially towards the end of this story. It's going to be...
Whether that's this year, three, or four.
Right. We don't know if it's going to be this season or season three or season four. Yeah. But when things culminate is what I really cannot wait to see what happens. Because there's some good stuff coming, John. Let me just tell you.
I bet. Well, you know, I don't know. as we talked about, I don't have a lot as far as grounding when it comes to the story is concerned, because I never played the game. But I can tell you that in the cold open, it's intense. Everything she's doing is intense. She is delivering it pretty well. And it's funny because you can almost feel her friends like back away from her in a way. Like they almost kind of like just pull away because she feels like she's a bomb that's about to explode. So she's great. I think she's going to be incredible. She's going to be a great addition to the show. I wonder where the story is going to go from here, because as somebody who is likable and the actress is somebody that I like to see on screen, I almost want to see her get along with our heroes, but we know that's not going to be possible. So whatever is going to happen is going to happen. Let's talk about Ellie and Dinah, or Dina. Like, what do you think about this low-key date and their encounter with the new clicker?
I think that the relationship between the two of them was very believable. I was a little nervous when I first saw the actress playing Dina with her hair down, talking to Joel. I was like, this character does not look like Dina to me at all. And then when they got to the New Year's party and her hair was up and she was wearing that shirt and you've got the lights, that is a very iconic shot to me. And I was sold on her being Dina at that point. And I'm 100% in. I thought her acting was great. I just didn't think she looked like Dina until that moment. Troy, you with me?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting how they introduced her with that conversation with Joel. And I think in that moment, you're like, I hate to say the word, like, too pretty, but she was almost like too pretty, yeah, from what I remember from Dina being in the game, right? I mean, they're workers, they're patrollers, or they're wearing hats all day. You know, it's like to see like the whole like blowout kind of thing was a little bit distracting, I think, a little bit. But at the same time, you know, seeing how she handled herself, and there's that whole conversation about, oh, you're going to get back together soon. And she's like really like lighting up the dance floor and, you know, playing up to everybody. She is the eye of attention. And then I have that scene between her and Ellie with the dialogue to say, no, they're looking at you tonight. I think that was a powerful moment. They nailed that one perfectly, including the Dyke comment and then Joel stepping in. Like all of that was just, you know, chef's kiss, yep, right on point, which was amazing.
How'd you do that, John?
Oh, well, I think Dina, whatever. I think she's an interesting character, and I like the actress.
Same.
Isabella Merced, and she's been in a lot of things that I've enjoyed. I did not watch the Dora the Explorer movie, so I can't say whether or not that was great or not. But I remember the very first time I saw her, which was in the second Mark Wahlberg Transformers movie, and I thought, what is she doing here? And thankfully they didn't do anything weird, like any Michael Bay-ish things, but I thought she was a joy to watch. So the times I've run into her on screen, I've really enjoyed her. I liked her here, and I liked the way that she lightens the room. She's very airy.
Yeah.
She's very much like, she takes the seriousness out of every moment. And it's not like she does it in a way that's silly or stupid. She just does it by her presence. And it's a powerful thing, really, when it comes to a lot of these moments. And she puts a lot of people in their place just by looking at them. And she uses that whatever that quality is. So it's not like she's trying to talk down to anyone. It's not like she's trying to overpower anyone. She just kind of like, hey, reality's here. Do you want to just join me and have a little bit of fun with it? And I thought that was great about her character.
And I think it also reminds us too of people that remember Riley from, I believe it was episode 7 of the first season. Mm-hmm. Right? Riley was her friend that they went to the mall with when she got bit. And that's when they found out that she actually was immune. Right. There was that relationship between her and Riley that was kind of budding. So you knew that there was this lesbian attraction thing, or maybe a bisexual attraction, because we don't really know, you know, how Ellie leans. But at the time, it also reminds us of that. Oh, yeah, she did have that thing right with Riley back then. So this makes sense that this would be happening now 5 years later still.
Well, and I love the misdirection, too, when they're actually going on patrol and Dinah is talking to her about, like, who you're going to bring to the party. Once you bring, I can't remember the girl that's on patrol, and she's like, why would I bring her? It's like, oh, she's the other one. Like, I just thought that was that whole misdirection of, because we knew, Troy, right? Like, we knew.
Oh, yeah, we knew.
That this kiss was going to happen later on, and Dinah was just playing with her. But, John, I'm curious how that came across before you knew that this was a love interest thing? Or were you clued off when she was trying to button her coat or whatever when they were before they left for patrol?
Oh yeah, it was no secret.
Okay.
At no moment did I sit there and go, oh, that looks completely normal. No.
Okay.
She's got this very matronly, very loving character about her, and it is not in a way of like anything other than the fact that there's like a it's just pure emotion that's kind of fun and sweet. And like, yeah, I at no point that I'd go, oh, that's something you do with just your buddy. No, because mm-hmm. I mean, I love you, Scott, but I'm not going to sit there and like button you up and make sure that you look tough and all that stuff before we go on patrol, you know?
I mean, I would I'd help you with your jacket, Scott. I just don't know if I'd have you like smell my hair for an extended period of time. That's all.
Well, if your hair smelled like guava, then maybe I would do that. But
hey,
yeah, maybe.
No, I really like that, and I'm excited to see where that whole thing goes as well. It's very interesting. I feel like we're in this Game of Thrones moment where I was always frustrated with people that read the books and knew it was coming in the episodes, and I'm that guy. But I'm going to continue to be that guy because we don't get this happening with video game adaptations very often, where it is like so parallel to the original property and still works. Fallout has probably been the only other one that's been close, and that's not even like a same story. That's a completely separate story, but there are little nuggets throughout that show that give nods to those that played the game. This is one where the story is, as of right now, matching up almost beat by beat by beat, and I hope that continues I hope it goes the way I said, where I can still have some surprises in season 3 and then go back and play the game. Or season 4, excuse me, and then play part 3 of the game in 10 years or whatever, because that's what I'm looking forward to.
Whenever it finally happens, when we're sitting in the retirement home trying to figure out how the remote controls work.
Oh, dude, that's going to be catch-up time for us, man. I'm gonna get caught up on so many shows in retirement.
Yeah, right. What do you guys think about that scene with Robert John Burke, who plays Seth, where he calls the girls the D word and is like upset because we're in a church and it's a family event and they're sitting there kissing. What do we and then Joel shows up to like defend Ellie. Now, I know from a storytelling point of view is that that was how they wanted to really land that whole tension between Joel and Ellie. Like he comes to save her and she's just kind of like, you know, F off, dude, what are you doing? Like I could protect myself. Like I know that's exactly why that moment is there. But what do you think about that moment? Do you think there could have been a better way of handling that, or was that the right way to handle that?
I think it was the right way to handle it because I know why Ellie's upset. I can't tell you why, but I know why Ellie's upset. And I think that was Joel also knowing why he's upset and him doing anything that he can to get her attention. Kind of like the boy at school that wants to get the girl's attention by pulling her hair. You know what I mean? Like doing something that's going to annoy her. That's exactly what Joel is doing. Like he is just trying to do anything that he possibly can think of to get back into Ellie's life in some way because she's straight up ignoring him. And that's just the opportune moment that he had. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense. I would say that I wouldn't say that he's the boy pulling on her hair. I think it's more so like he's white knighting for her in every single opportunity he can.
Right. It's the same thing. It's just that, but that's why he's doing it. He's not doing it because he wants to protect Ellie as much as he just wants to reinsert himself into her situation whenever she can.
Right. Because if I'm Joel, if I'm not protecting Ellie, then what am I?
Right.
Right. He's starting to get there. He's a construction guy. He's doing what he did back before this whole thing went down in 2003, September 26th. But at the same time, he's now...
Let me just pull that date out of my back pocket. Excuse me.
Hey, robot.
Last of Us Day, man. Got to celebrate it every year. Prepare for the worst. Climate is getting warmer. Joel is an interesting character. He's in a place where like he made these decisions. He's got to live with these decisions. He lost his daughter. He gained a pseudo daughter. The daughter doesn't want to talk to him. So he's dealing with a lot right now. And he's also got, you know, his sister-in-law basically breathing down his back to build more houses and go faster. And at the same time, there's now cordyceps running through the sewage system. So there's just a lot on Joel's plate. And I think that this scene in particular is great from a writing perspective, because you have to have the setup piece, right? So we know that Joel and Ellie have to have this confrontation. So how do we get them to have this confrontation? What do they fight about, right? So let's go ahead and throw this other thing in here. But it also goes to show that they're not just throwing it in to throw it in to start the next thing, right? It's not the hopscotch to get to the thing that we need to get to. It's also saying, hey, we're this community, we're human, and we're trying to figure out what that is again. And oh, by the way, we weren't the greatest people in a lot of ways, you mm-hmm. know, and that stuff is still sitting there. We never talked about it. We were just dealing with what we had to deal with, but we never evolved past society 5 years ago, or even now, do the math. What was it? 25 years ago, roughly, right? Back to when this whole thing started. 24. I mean, we're still talking about these same issues 5 years later that we should have put to bed if this, you know, infection, you know, pandemic never happened. Some shit getting to Jackson.
They've seen some shit. All right. So like we like to do in this show, we like to end the show by trying to figure out who we think the winner of the episode is. So I'm going to go around the room. We're going to ask you guys, and I didn't prep these guys at all. So right, I'm going to say a couple more words to give them a couple of seconds to think about who the winner of the episode is. But Troy, if you had to choose, who do you think the winner of the episode is?
I'd still give it to Ellie for this one. You know, Ellie reintroduced us to the world. She reintroduced us to her plight. We know she's being cavalier with her situation because she thinks she can't die and she's invincible. So she's like reestablishing, like, that is the whole reason she exists, is the fact that she's the miracle Jesus of the entire thing. And I'm just going to do what I'm going to do, because apparently there's no way to find a cure. So I have to give it to her for making sure people understood that that's what she was in that first season, and mm-hmm. still there today.
All right.
I'm going to go with Gail. And not just because it's an easy answer, because like, it's the first time we've seen her and we don't know if we're mm-hmm. going to see her again. But just watching her shift in emotions from let's celebrate my birthday to I'm going to drop a truth bomb on you. I'm now dropping a truth bomb on you. I now regret dropping that truth bomb on you, but let's talk about it. All within the span of about 90 seconds.
Oh my God.
Was so a beautiful roller coaster of emotions, and just the look of satisfaction and fear combined on her face after she delivered those lines, to me, made her the winner, because she got through something that was maybe not as brutal as some of the physical altercations and psychological altercations that Joel and Ellie have gone through in the first season. But this was as close as you're going to get without resorting to violence.
Yeah. All right. So my pick is going to be Ellie. And it's simple.
It's for the line.
Sniped like a pro. Well, there's still, yeah, the line doesn't hurt. She sniped like a pro, swore like a sailor. She flirted like it was the pre-apocalypse. And she's still, like, she wasn't even trying. She still managed to throw Joel into an emotional tailspin. Like, she just had to look at him and walk away. And Joel's like, I'm gonna cry. Great. It's just, like, it's hard to watch him go through it. But she's, like, again, she's not even trying to do it to him.
Mm-hmm. And she has excellent music taste.
And she has excellent music taste. So, all right. So that's it, everybody. That's the first episode of The Last of Us Season 2. I want to thank you guys for stopping by and recording this with me, Scotty.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it. I am in for the season.
Troy?
I'm stoked for next week to see what's going to be coming around the corner, because someone's coming knocking on the door and might not be who you think.
Yeah. No knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door for us.
I don't think Jackson's going to be heaven for long.
Yeah. Mm-mm. All right, everybody, this is going to be a weekly show. We are going to be pumping this out as soon as the episodes can. And again, thank you very much for being our Patreon supporters. We look forward to killing you soon. And scene.